Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Welcome back, sports fans, to another episode of the Charity Stripe Podcast, brought to you by the Believe Podcast Network, the number one sports podcast network in Los Angeles. For those listening at home, on the road, in the air, or in the water, do you believe? We have a great show for you guys today. AJ Schnock, the director of Long Gone Summer, the 30 for 30 documenting Sosa versus McGuire on the home run chase to beat Roger Maris' 61 record in the summer of 98, joins the boys to talk the documentary and a whole lot more. So buckle up, tuck it into your waistband, because here we go. 3, 2, 1. We're back.
We sitting here, I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Clock at 5. Pass is intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler. Rebound box. Back out to Allen. His three-pointer. Bang! Tie game! Gives it to Jenkins for the championship. He's going for the corner. He's got it. Bases loaded. Two out.
We're back, baby. It's the Charity Stripe. Pitch your free throws, because they're free. So 249 coming hot at you guys, and so 248. And as you heard in the introduction, we have a great show with AJ Schnock, the director of Long Gone Summer. He's hopping on with Toss and I. It's a great one. We're super stoked for you guys to hear it. And so without further ado, enough dilly-dallying. Let's get into the show with AJ Schnock. Enjoy. You heard it in the introduction, guys. We have director AJ Schnock. You just watched Long Gone Summer, 30 for 30, ESPN. And I'm always excited for a guest, but you're the first guest, AJ, that I actually have a bone to pick with, because the way you directed that thing, you almost changed my mind on the steroid era. You were really you could ask Alex, anybody that listens to this show knows that I'm the kind of guy that if you took steroids, you're out. I don't want nothing to do with you. The records don't count. But Alex and I were just talking about it before. The way you humanize these guys was admirable, I have to say. And I'm curious to see, are there other people reacting like me? Has that been a reaction? Are you surprised by that reaction? Or was that something you were intending when you were making the film?
A few people have told me that. I mean, there's definitely people who are, you know, it's just made them more mad, you know? they're just like still, you know, F those guys, because you know what they did, and they ruined baseball. It's just a funny, it's such a hard thing to wrap your brain around, because so, you know, with the steroid era, we just aren't. There's so much we will never know. You know, we'll never know like how many people were doing it, who was doing it, what pitchers were doing it. You know, you start looking at, you know, individual like showdowns between a pitcher and a hitter, and like who knows who, which or both or neither. And we don't really know like what steroids can do. I mean, there have been some scientific studies that give us some idea of what the percentages are in terms of how far, much farther a baseball can be hit, or how much faster you can throw it. But it's like this weird era that we will always have a ton of questions around. And you know, it's unfortunate that the players, to me, it's unfortunate that the players have borne most of the brunt of the anger over that era, when it seems like you could, if you want to blame people, you could certainly have a lot of blame to pass around.
Interesting. I mean, there's a level of pressure, and you see that mainly with McGuire. Sosa's still pretty jovial, which we were kids. Like, I was 4 years old, and so was Toss when this was made, when that went down. And so I kind of have like a vague memory of it, but it's mainly me looking at Baseball Reference and going, okay, he hit 70, he hit 66, the record was 61, they broke it. You know, mm-hmm. But Sosa, you don't remember that Sosa was so jovial, and he still is that guy. But McGuire, you really see, like such a timid kind of guy, and you could really kind of see how it got to him and that pressure, you know, to perform. Were you surprised by that, or did you kind of have that go? Did you kind of know who these guys were going in? Was there a heads up?
I kind of knew their personalities. I mean, I think if you look at McGuire in particular, his coaching career, you know, his second act in baseball, he coached for the Cardinals, Dodgers, and Padres from, you know, 2011 up until 2019, and you never heard about him. I mean, he it was actually difficult to find photos of him as a coach during that era, and that to me is like, okay, so that's what he. That is, if he had his druthers, how he would like to have his baseball life, is just put his head down, be around the game, teach people, do his thing. He hits like the ball an incredibly long way, and everybody wants to ask him, well, how often are you going to do that? Are you going to keep doing it? Are you going to hit these records? He values baseball as a team game, as a team sport, and doesn't like the fact that he was the individual kind of put forward. So there's a little bit of dread and shyness, you know, to all of his playing career. And then you had Sosa, who was just having the time of his life.
Yeah,
and to me, it's like the thing that was so starkly different between the two, and you captured it so well, was that like they're hitting the same amount of home runs, and Sosa just has none of those pressures. I have to think that some of it has to do with where he's from too, and that McGuire is an American guy. It was just a really awesome doc. I think one thing that I obviously, like, you know about McGuire's power growing up, like Josh and I with our age and stuff like that, but you know less about their personalities, and you can see even now that some of the pressures that are involved when Marcus, even in front of the camera, I mean, was that something that just like getting him to open up and getting him to talk about it? How was that? How did you go about doing that?
Mm-hmm. It took a while just talking to him in advance. I met with him twice. He's down in Southern California as I am. And so we met up in person without cameras, just kind of talking about what I wanted to do, what, you know, whether he'd be comfortable with what I was asking for, which was, you know, sitting down for lengthy periods of time, which is something he just does not do. To do it more than once, and for every question to be it was an open season in terms of what questions I could ask. So it took, I think, a year just kind of to get him comfortable with that idea while I was also pursuing Sosa. And, you know, when he came and sat down in the interview, he started talking and telling me stuff that I'd, you know, done a bunch of research, stuff I'd never heard before. So right away, I was pretty much like, oh, he's really doing it. Like he's here to do what I hoped he would do, or what I asked him to do. So, you know, that was really great. Ultimately, I mean, you talked about the, just the race itself. If you look at just the race itself, one of the things that's so amazing about it is that people were talking about the record before the season even started. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, we don't talk about these things until the All-Star break or much later in the year, when it seems like, okay, the person is on pace. It makes sense that they might actually be able to do this. But that was, you know, the questions for both McGuire and Ken Griffey Jr. were coming in spring training. You know, is this the year? In part because it was an expansion year, so they knew the pitching talent pool was going to be a little bit weaker. Some ballparks, including Busch Stadium, had been reconfigured to make them a little bit friendlier to hitters. Mm-hmm. So there were good reasons to think it might be that year, but it was very unusual for there to be all that kind of pressure on McGuire and Griffey. None of that pressure, of course, on Sosa. And even when he, you know, gets to the place where he's running even with Griffey and then catching up to McGuire, never feels sort of the same level of pressure to actually be the one to break it or to hold it at the end of the year.
And that's why I think he was having more fun, because there was nobody. It was unexpected. You knew Sosa was good, and obviously he goes on to crank like 62 more times, which is just nuts, you know. But yeah, there's no pressure. No one's expecting Slam and Sammy Sosa to compete with those two guys. Now, Griffey, he wasn't in the dock as much. Was that an angle you wanted to take, or you kind of avoided that, or he just kind of doesn't want to associate necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, we reached out, and I would have loved to have, you know, talked to him and found out what it was like from his perspective. And also, you know, we had a bunch of people in Seattle we wanted to interview. Like, what is, you know, what was that like? Did people in Seattle get excited about it in the way that, you know, people in St. Louis were, and then later in Chicago? You know, I think he was beginning production. There's an MLB doc about him that I think it's going to come out this weekend.
Oh, so cool. Yeah,
he was beginning production on that, and probably felt like, you know what, if I got my own, if I got my own real estate going, I don't need to be the third wheel in this story again. I already played that once, and in truth, because we were limited, we had 2 hours, we couldn't go over. It would have been tough to fit in his story and done it justice, I think.
Yeah, totally, man. And I gotta, what was your main goal going into it? Like, you're going into this documentary, how do you even come about it? Because your other stuff is, you're all across the board. You're Kurt Cobain to politics and now to the home run chase, which is, my mind goes in those places a lot of the time when I'm watching CNN, listening to music and watching baseball. But I don't think I can make a documentary about all three different categories. So kind of how'd you fall into it, and what was your main goal going into it?
I just, you know, I had great memories of that summer. I grew up outside of St. Louis, got a lot of Cubs fans in my extended family. Yeah. So the rivalry is a big part of my sports memories, you know, going to games, listening to games with my dad were big sports memories.
Was your dad a Cubs fan?
No, dad was a Cardinals fan, although he did grow up and go to school in Chicago.
Nice. So you're a good son. I'm a Patriots fan. My dad's a Jets fan, and his dad's a Patriots fan. So it's skipped a generation. It's War of the Worlds in our house.
It happens. I think baseball, though, is more of a thing where you, like, it is a kind of passed down, you know, parent to children, the traditions and the you know, allegiances.
I screwed him there, too. I'm a Sox fan. I blew it across the board. I'm a disappointment. But yeah, so your family, Cubs, Cardinals, it was with you as a kid, were growing up.
Yeah, and just like, so when that summer happened, I'd moved out to LA by that point. I was working in film and, you know, kind of fell away from baseball a little bit because of the strike. Hadn't been quite able to embrace the Dodgers yet. So when that happened and it was involving these two teams that were, you know, all part of my childhood, everything about that summer just kind of took me back to what I grew up with. And it was exciting. It was emotional. So, you know, all these years later, when I started talking to ESPN about doing a film with them, you know, this is obviously something in my head, but I just had to assume there was a big reason why they'd never done it, because it was such an obvious story for the 30 for 30 brand. And I think in part, it was just that they could never get all the players. They couldn't get Sosa, McGuire, they couldn't get the Cardinals, the Cubs, and Major League Baseball all to just go like, yes, this is the concept, this is the filmmaker we want to do the film with. And
from a fan's perspective, we forget about a lot, just like the importance of mentors in sports. I was really moved by Tony La Russa's relationship.
That was a great aspect, man. That was cool.
With Mark, and just kind of like the shepherding that he did. There's not many other sports. Like in basketball, Steph Curry breaks the 3-point record, but at the beginning of the season, no one is paying attention to that, right? No one's putting the pressure on Steph Curry to do that. They want to win the NBA championship. And for La Russa to be aware of that, I mean, just shows, I mean, there's a reason why he was a GM for so long, right? It was really cool. I love that angle. And I loved kind of hearing him talk about Mark. And so, yeah, kudos on that. I think that that's something that we see a lot, and hopefully we see more of that. Like, who are the people that are molding these athletes and in their ear, and kind of what are they listening to? Who are they sponging with, you know, in their growth?
Yeah. I mean, La Russa, that was a crazy interview. We thought we were only going to get 45 minutes with him. And so, you know, you have so much you want to talk about. This is a guy who was with Mark for all but about a year of his playing career, and then brings him back as a coach, and is, you know, has him coach with him. So that this is a, you know, it was a unique scenario that Mark played, not just for La Russa, but but Dave McKay and a bunch of the other like A's people, Walt Jocketty, who go over the Cardinals together, you know, that they have this long relationship where people can talk to us both about Mark's time with the A's, which is its own crazy history and story, as well as when he comes to the Cardinals. But yeah, we thought we were going to have 45 minutes and ended up talking to Tony for like 3 hours.
Do you do it all in one session?
It was all in one session. Yeah. I mean, we went to Rhode Island. He was working with the Red Sox at the time and they have a minor league team there. Yeah. In Pawtucket. So we did it at that stadium on like early one morning.
The background was nice. I noticed that. I was like, all right.
He did have a very nice background.
Like, nice job, AJ. Yeah.
So we didn't know like how much we'd get. And then it was just, we just kept talking. And so that was a really great interview.
Yeah, that's great. You didn't touch on the steroids that much, which is great. Did you know that you were going to do that going in? Did you really want to focus on that single season? I mean, because obviously everyone's expecting it, so you kind of have to, you know, linger it in, and you did at the end. But was that the main goal? Was that a main goal of yours to kind of really avoid that into the end and really just focus on that one season?
The goal was to do a chronological story and to really get you back in it to the extent that you can kind of strip away the framing of the steroid era as much as you can. And for some people, they'll never be able to strip it away. It's like the first second they see one of those balls go into the upper deck, they're like, you know, roids, mad. But the situation, I think, that was interesting to me was, you know, can we put you back if you experienced it at the time or if you didn't, and show you just how crazy that season was and how it became something that was bigger than baseball, bigger than sports, really touched all aspects of the culture. And then, of course, you know, we have to have this, I look at the final act as like kind of the sad epilogue where, you know, after you've seen something that made so many people so happy, you know, has just this kind of trail afterwards that is filled with, you know, these guys kind of not getting, you know, the happiness that they gave. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to the extent with steroids in the third act, in the middle of the film, we spend a good deal of time talking about when the androstenedione is written about in Mark's locker and the use of supplements in baseball and how baseball has become more of a gym culture and a culture around building up your muscles and working out. To me, those two things, they're two sides of the same coin. All of the things that were happening with the supplements, the kind of blind eye that baseball was turning to them, not wanting to really know what people were doing, and the reasons why people were doing the supplements are all the same things that were going on with steroids. One of them just happened to be illegal in the country against the country's laws, and the other ones were involving legal supplements, even if they were not necessarily approved in other sports.
Yeah, that was like, there's certain guys like on the Balco report, you know, like Schaaf, Palmeiro, and A-Rod, like they're juicing. But a guy like McGuire, it's in his locker. Like it's in, he doesn't know, he doesn't really think of it, you know, and he's just using it to recover because, I mean, that's the crazy thing about, and you did a nice job of this, man, because you see Griffey Jr., even though he's not in the dock, but you did a nice job, you know, having his kind of third line in there. You really see how hard Maris's record is, and it's not, the home runs are not a strength thing. It's an endurance thing. Griffey tapered off, and you see how many times we see like some, you know, schlub crank, not to say schlub, I mean, these guys are pros. But, you know, some, like, guy that we don't know. I can remember, like, years ago, Chris Shelton, Tigers. No one's going to know who that is, really. Hit 10 home runs in April. Everyone's like, he's going to break the record. Didn't hit, like, two more the rest of the year. Guys catch up, and they taper off. And the endurance of these guys. And McGuire's just doing it to stay healthy and to stay, you know, and it's unfortunate.
I mean, you looked at Bellinger last year, you know, and the Dodgers were so exciting to watch, and Cody was so, like, exciting to watch. And, you know, as you went along, you're like, well, I don't know, maybe he's like, he's hitting pretty well. He's on a pace. Then when he slows down come August and September, it's not that he's like doing poorly, you know,
he's tired.
I mean, he's still doing great, but it's just like you hit a point, you hit a wall of being able to do it. And I think there's a mental thing as well. When people start like putting the pressure, like, why aren't you hitting home runs? Sosa talks about, you know, why the pressure was on Mark, you know, that if he didn't hit a home run, it would be like, well, Sosa hit a home run, why didn't you hit a home run? You know, I mean, that kind of the questioning from the media and you know, just the expectations that you put on yourself to perform, You know, there's a lot of reasons why people are start to fade come August and September. And, you know, by starting to fade, it could be just meaning that you hit 5 instead of 10, which is not a poor performance. It's just not going to keep you on that pace.
On that ridiculous, ridiculous pace. Did they tell you is there anything that, you know, kind of that surprised you that they said, like, Sosa and McGuire that you didn't really expect? I know you said earlier that Mark, there was a couple things you'd researched and McGuire hit you kind of blindsided. You go, oh, wow, he's like really into it and he's going to really delve into it. Like, what were some of the most surprising things for you hearing those two speak?
I mean, from McGuire, I had never heard him talk about being in therapy before. I knew that he had had really strong mental focus and that was a big part of why he was able to kind of stay in it in like 97, 98, 99, as opposed to in his rookie year when, you know, he felt all those pressures and wasn't quite ready to bear up to them yet. So that was one thing I was surprised about. I was surprised about him writing down a list of things he wanted to do in a season.
That came up and I was like, how did you even get on that topic? Like, we talk about like something that, you know, mental psychology, that's something that we talk about today. At the doc 15 years, had to happen 15 years ago, maybe he wouldn't have opened up about that he went to therapy. And also, like, you know, people are all big on affirmations now, right? It's like you write down what you're going to be, you write down what you're going to do. For him to be doing that back then, he's really, really, that's like good mental psychology practice, which is like, yeah, talk a little bit about that. Sorry.
I mean, he really does think that he's like one of the first people to like really practice those things in the sport. Him saying that he wrote down what he needed to do, what he expected of himself. That was something that, you know, when I asked La Russa about it, La Russa said, you know, I'm as close to him as anyone. And I didn't know he did that. But that is is sort of a clue to, what he expected and was trying to do. Whereas just in terms of when he would talk to people, he would always say, I'm not trying to do it. It's, you know, if it happens, it happens, you know, which, you know, we now find out, you know, in truth, he really did want it. He did think it was possible. He knew it was an expansion year. And if it was going to happen, that would probably be the year to do it. And he was focused on actually achieving that record. I'd never heard him admit before that he started that season with the intention of breaking the record.
Which is a great tidbit. Yeah. And then, I mean, we had a guy on that. Was it Pomerantz we had on the show 2 weeks ago?
I was about to bring that up. We had Drew Pomerantz on the show, and he was talking about kind of just what he does year in, year out, and how setting goals for him is something that one of his coaches, I think,
Randy Wolf.
Was it? Was it Randy? Yeah. It was Randy Wolf who had told him that that's
what
he did.
May have played with McGuire. I don't know off the top of my head. He's been on so many teams. I feel like he has. I mean, maybe
they got passed from McGuire to Wolf to Pomerantz.
Maybe. Yeah, like they crossed in the Padres somehow. I don't know. My nerd level is not off the radar right now in that regard. But it's crazy that Pomerantz did that, you know. And I'm curious to see how many other athletes do that and really, you know, because we the pressure we put on these guys to be team oriented. Rings, championships. It starts with Michael Jordan, it goes to Tom Brady, you know, and it goes to Jeter, and it goes to like the best guys in the sport win. Baseball, you could kind of get away with it. Like Ken Griffey Jr. doesn't have one. He's still regarded as one of the GOATs, you know. But even Pujols, it was like a big deal for him to get a ring. But it's crazy to, you know, hear it. And it's, I think as I've gotten older, I'm like, all right, good for them for wanting to. Because I know I have my own personal goals, and there's no poo-poo in having an athlete having their own individual goals as well. So that's nice to hear. And it's crazy that, no, he had never shared that before.
Yeah.
I definitely, when I was younger, baseball was a sport that while I was playing, I was paying a lot more attention. I'm from Dallas, so I'm a Rangers fan. And so, you know, we had some rough times growing up, and then we hit a nice
capital
we hit
of the
it,
world in baseball.
Man. Or just the capital of bringing a guy up through the farm, having him have one good year and then shipping him off to somewhere else. But a lot of people are talking right now about, you know, as basketball becomes such a big thing in the media and there's so much hype around it, especially for the younger generation, that baseball is getting lost, right? And that even with everything that's happening, with the amount of home runs that people are hitting, I mean, you could look at a guy like Pete Alonso last year, right? Like what he did was incredible. And you look back at the Sosa McGuire, what they were doing for the sport at the time, what do you think is something that could change kind of young kids' approach to baseball and bringing people back to the sport like they were gravitating towards it, you know, in 98 with this home run race?
You know, I don't know. I mean,
it's a big question, I know, but
yeah, I think the thing I would really like it if everybody who was responsible for a team or for the league was doing everything they were doing out of an innate love, a passionate love of the game and why they love the game, why they like to watch a game on TV, why they like to hear it on the radio, why they want, you know, to be in the stands on a hot summer, you know, evening. I look at some of the things that have happened over the last, you know, decade. And I mean, here in Los Angeles, you know, I've come to really love the Dodgers, and you know, the fact that we're just now, after years, figuring out how people might be able to watch their games without, you know, buying into one specific cable channel is just nuts to me. Like, it used to be that the games were always available on some free TV, you know, channel. You could watch, you could listen, you know, I'm sure there'd be the occasional blackout date, but the notion that we have, basically, we're just trying to commodify every single aspect. And it's not just about, like, you know, how much we love or care about the game. And I think that is, when you take a sport like baseball, which is really about, it's not about, like, you know, the flashiness of baseball or, I mean, of basketball, or, you know, the excitement of a football drive, you know, it's about being there. It's about having a beer. It's about hanging out with your friends. It's about, like, having a scorecard. It's about, like, knowing you're going to spend 3 hours in that atmosphere.
It's a commitment. You know, it's a fun commitment, yeah, but it's a commitment. Yeah.
A fun commitment. It's a night out or an afternoon out, you know? And that's, I just feel like we've, a lot of decisions have been made over the past decade that don't come from that place. They just think it's about, like, well, how can we tweak this to make some money in the margins? And I just don't know how that is successful long term.
It's old money versus new money is my theory. The guys that own, and this is not me, I know a couple people, this is, you know, whatever, fugaz about that, me knowing anybody. But from what I've seen close up, and nothing against the owners, they're just old money people. So they're looking at it as like a business versus Steve Ballmer, who owns the Clippers. He's got all the money in the world, and he's like, all right, this is cool, man. I own a basketball team. Let's have some fun. You know, and this is, it's, yeah, like, it's a hobby for him, and it's all about the love for the game. And the thing that, what struck me with your documentary, man, was in 98, it was a superstar driven league. People were excited about baseball in June, and no one's excited about baseball in June anymore. It was a superstar driven league. It was Sosa. It was Griffey. Mike Trout is the best player ever playing in Los Angeles. Jacob DeGrom is a back-to-back Cy Young winner playing in New York. You have the two best at either on pitching and hitting playing in two of the biggest markets. And what's the big story? The Astros cheated 2 years ago. It's just they don't do a good job controlling, and you're a narrative controller, and they don't do a good job controlling the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, you think of all the one-name, you know, superstars of that era who we knew and who people tuned in on. And yeah, I don't think baseball hasn't done a good job of like, telling us, you know, there are those of us who, like, maybe we follow baseball a lot, or we were just so obsessed with our own team and we know everybody that they're going to play, but maybe we don't know what's going on in the other league as much, or, you know, maybe we're only focused on what our team is doing, or we're just watching the occasional game. They've done nothing, I think, to help us understand, like, if you don't play Mike Trout, like, do you know who he is? If you're, like, you know, in the Chicago Cubs and you're not, like, a huge baseball fan. I just, that to me is like we're not telling the story of baseball very well, I don't think.
Yeah. You know. I mean, I think it's if I'm growing up in Dallas right now, I want to go to a Mavs game when they're playing LeBron James. You know, I want to go to that game because I want to go see greatness. And that's something, you know, which in your documentary you talked about where if they're going on a road game, you know, McGuire goes to Florida and puts on the performance of a lifetime in
no
that
one goes,
series.
No one ever goes to those games, and people were and packed.
And they're running across the tarps. I mean, that was like, that image just popped
that was
out
a good
to
one
me
too, man. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
I was like, shit, I don't know people ever went to that, even when they won the World Series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, and I could see that guy. I could see him hit a home run a million times, and every single time I would still be amazed. My jaw would drop to the floor because it happens every single time. The guy's power, whether you bring up steroids or not, I mean, it's just, it's incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, he, as he said, he can hit a ball a long, long way. I mean, like where those balls went sometimes, they're just, you know, they're insane. You know, but, you know, Griffey had one of the sweetest swings ever. And Sosa's ability to go the opposite way. I mean, it was a special time to be watching baseball. For sure.
Oh yeah. I pray to God every night my future wife looks like Ken Griffey Jr. swing. Like, I get on my – that's, like, my big wish. I hate to be shallow, but that's just a matter of fact. When you get in the room, because this is – because we interview guys, yeah. I mean, we interview, obviously. We try to delve in because we're in Los Angeles, so we'll spread around, go producers, actors. We do keep in the sports realm. And I remember we interviewed our first NFL player as quarterback, and he walked into our studio, and I was like, holy shit, this guy, I get it. Was it like that with McGuire? Did you kind of, the minute he walked in, were you like, wow, I could see how this guy could crank a lot of home runs, and Sosa too? Or were you like, because I remember I've also seen guys even like, wait a second, you're the starting running back for that team? Like Dev Singletary toss. Remember when he was walking by? I was like,
yeah, how about Aaron Donald? I mean, that guy's obviously he's built like a house, but he's not nearly as tall as I thought he was going to be.
AJ, he was short. If you've never seen him in real life, he was not like me and my cowboy boots was like stacking up next to him real good, man. For real. Was there a level of surprise with Sosa and McGuire, or could you kind of tell, even though they're a bit older?
Yeah, I mean, I had, because I'd spent a little time with him before we sat down with cameras, I kind of knew what to expect. I think, you know, the thing with Sammy was, you know, when I met him, he came out and he had written down a list of questions for me and just kind of went down the list just so he understood everything he wanted to know and didn't forget anything in terms of like what I wanted to do or, mm-hmm. you know, what the film was going to be. And it was fairly low key. It wasn't, I mean, it was a good talk, but I didn't feel like he was, you know, showboaty in any way, or like, you know, it was just kind of direct and asking me questions, kind of, I wouldn't say soft spoken, but you know, it wasn't anything like big. And then when we got in to do the interview, he walked in and it's the interview where you see where he says, "I'm ready for the fight." And, you know, there's that beautiful painting of his family behind him, and mm-hmm. he's wearing this blue suit. He just came in and he was like, he was Sammy, you know, and he was kind of dancing in his chair. And I was like, oh, this is interesting, because I had met him in that, it's in his house. I had met him in the same living room. And to see the difference between the person who came out with his list of questions and the person who was ready to be in the show was really, really interesting.
Yeah, that's great. And I, now knowing these guys, do you think it's blasphemous that the Cubs won't let, like, have cut off all ties knowing these guys now? I mean, I know what he did was wrong, and I'm sure he does, even though he's really not said it yet. I know what he's done is wrong. So do you think it's kind of blasphemous, though, that they, you don't have, listen, I'm not saying retire his jersey, but welcome him back at least, you know, Severson, you know, bring the, don't sever all ties forever. And B, do you think if these, it's interesting because the Lance doc, I don't know if this was ESPN planned it, I don't know if you guys were on board with this, but the Lance doc and you guys were pretty close, and it's kind of covering not the same thing, but there's elements that obviously cross over with steroids. And Lance says in his documentary that he wishes he just kind of said it and right away admitted it, and that was it. Do you think if these guys admitted it right away or came clean right away, that they'd be welcomed into the Hall of Fame, or do you think there'd still be kind of this pushback and still be this, you know, exiling going on? And do you think the Cubs cannot? Do you think it's ridiculous that the Cubs have yet to bring Sosa back in?
I mean, I always wonder what would happen if if instead of like just talking about supplements in 98, if it had come out that anyone was using steroids, and, you know, that was, you know, if Mark had said like, oh yeah, I'm using these because it's not against the rules, you know, and there's no penalties, there's no testing, you know, how people would have taken it in the moment. Would people have been upset? Would the race be off? Would we have celebrated 62, would it have changed kind of our whole perspective on that season? You know, as far as Sammy, you know, I try to give the Cubs ownership the benefit of the doubt that maybe they looked at what happened when Mark was going back to coach with the Cardinals, so taking a job with the organization, not just, you know, coming back and waving to fans, that he, you know, issued his statement about when he used and what he used. And maybe the Cubs thought, okay, well, it makes sense that we think Sammy also used, even though the evidence is far less clear. We think Sammy also used, so he should do the same thing that Mark did. Like, he should also, like, come clean in kind of the same way. That is my guess. I don't know that for sure, but, you know, I think if that was their intention, was to be like, okay, well, these guys did the same thing, so we'll, you know, we'll treat it the same way. At this point, it just feels weird. I mean, it's just to have this fractured relationship between an all-century player and this organization. There's nothing comparable in baseball to it. No other player is being held out like Sammy is. The current ownership were not the owners of the Cubs at any point when he was a player. So the sins that Sammy may have committed against the Cubs, particularly toward the end of his Cub playing days, that was different ownership. I would hope that, you know, I mean, I just keep hoping that they're going to say, like, look, when baseball comes back to Wrigley after this, you know, time when we've been shut down because of the pandemic and figuring out how to play again, when baseball comes back to Wrigley, we're going to welcome Sammy back. That would seem to be a really great idea. I think the Cubs should do that.
You might as well at this point. It's like, how much do we have to penalize a human being? Like, you know what? I'm like, all right, my mentality is don't put A-Rod in the Hall of Fame. Well, we already suspended him 211 games and completely cost him a shot at the home run record, which now we know that guys have lists, guys do this. I'm sure he wanted to break with 762, A-Rod. There's no doubt in my mind that that's in the back of his, or for the, maybe the forefront of his mind after he gets the ring in New York. You know, and do we have to penalize him more and more? Like, when is enough enough? We drag Sosa's name through the mud. You know, he's now, his 609 is tarnished. Everything he's really worked for, steroids or not, is kind of, you know, thrown to the wayside. It's too much. It's just too much for one human. He's still a person, you know?
Yeah, it's not as if there hasn't been a penalty for these guys. You know, I mean, if you do think that Sammy used, you know, if you're mad at him about the cork bat and leaving the park on his last day with the Cubs, I mean, he's suffered a penalty for sure. I mean, he's not been able to escape, you know, that kind of framing around his career. And you know, that some of that's not going to go away just by the Cubs saying, you know what, you're a part of our history and, you know, we're going to celebrate it. I mean, they're still going to be part of it. I mean, look at Mark's second act as a coach being welcomed back to the Cardinals. He was inducted into the A's Hall of Fame last year. There's still people who will never, you know, be happy about what, you know, what he did or the fact that he, you know, his record, they believe is, you know, inauthentic. So they're still paying a price. I don't think it needs to include banishment from Wrigley.
And a couple more questions for you, man. One, sure. This is a quick one, and you could defer. You could plead the fifth if you want. is the record Bonds' / McGuire / Osha? Do you see it as broken, or as a fan, is it still 61 to you?
I think that we have to, you know, look at every era has its own issues. There have been very few times in baseball that have been totally righteous. You know, I think that Bonds has the record. There was no, at the time, no testing, no penalty, no agreement between players and owners to ban steroids. I don't think a memo is enough. So, you know, I think Bonds,
I'm preaching to the choir, Bonds, man. Memos are not. You could tell Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, memos are not enough. You know what I'm saying?
Memos are not enough. No. So Bonds is the home run king, but I will say, you know, if we now that baseball has testing in place, if we believe that we're in an era where the ball isn't like wound tight as a drum, you know, when the, you know, dimensions haven't been shrunk to half of what they are now.
Yeah.
You know, if we get into an era and somebody starts getting to 59, 60, you know, I'm super curious to see what happens.
Yeah, and, it's going to be interesting.
When someone gets to 62, how are we going to treat that? Are we going to treat that as a big deal and as something that is noteworthy and we should celebrate? Or are we just going to say, like, you still got 11 more to go?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you hit the ball 62 times past 400 feet, I'm going to think it's a big deal. I mean, I think the furthest ball I ever hit was over a 200-foot softball field when I was, like, a sophomore in high school. And I was like, this is the biggest moment of my entire life.
I want to see the Carfax on that. I want to see a replay on that, man, and a measuring tape.
200 feet? I did it. I had a metal bat aluminum bat. Yeah, it's not the same.
I hit 70 in the cage, and I was like, this is as good as this Jew from Long Island's going to do it, man.
I read, AJ, that because you mentioned COVID, so you were still working on the project after the pandemic hit.
Nuts.
I read that you took over like a lot of the roles just by yourself. Because is that true?
Yeah. So my editor had to go on paternity leave in January. So I've edited some of my other films.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I can finish it. I'll just come in and I'll finish the film. We found out in January that we were going to premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival. They had seen an early cut of the film, but there was still a ton of work to do. We were still getting music in. We were still getting archival in. And so I was doing, you know, these like late nights, just trying to get the film ready for Tribeca. Went to Chicago to work with my composer. And while I was there, I heard that South by Southwest had been canceled. And I was like, well, this is either, you know, the beginning of everything shutting down or some weird, crazy overreaction, because Austin can be nuts, obviously, during summer.
Whoa.
Easy, relax. Easy,
two UT alums. No.
No, yeah, do we
know? But you know what it's like. I mean, like everyone's like, Sixth Street is a madhouse. I mean, I've premiered like two films. I've shown three features at South By and premiered two.
Oh,
and
hell yeah.
Last time I was there was in 2013, and it's hard to move. And so I could understand, like, okay, if this is transmitted in that way, they don't want like the convention center to become like a crazy petri dish, which right. It would have done.
Sixth Street's a shit show. I don't blame them.
Yeah. So yeah, I got a week later, of course, or 5 or 6 days later was when the NBA shut down. And so then it was clear like everything's going and Tribeca is going to go soon. So we actually, because I'd been working so hard and the team had been working so hard, I was just like, okay, I'm just going to take a break. I'll take 2 weeks and just, you know, kind of walk away. And it's always good to do that anyway. At the end of the 2 weeks, we were to premiere later this summer. And, you know, while we initially, after Tribeca, we were going to have screenings around the country, it was pretty clear that people weren't going to be doing any screenings. But anyway, ESPN called me about at the end of the 2 weeks and said, we're going to move The Last Dance to April. And we want to follow it up with these three films. We would have actually premiered before Lance originally. Right. I think Lance was supposed to air like in October or November, and we were, I think, going to be timed to around September when the race when the anniversary of the breaking of the home run record was. So then it became all hands on deck, but nobody could be in the room with me. So I was finishing the editing, I was my own assistant editor, had to learn like all of this, like these new ways of sharing screens and technologies to work with my colorist and my sound mixer and my producers. And
well, you actually probably saw Maguire hit a million home runs.
Now you can speak to Toss's like wish. Like, I can watch this guy hit home runs all day. And he's like, no, you have no idea.
There were so many times when I actually would realize, because we were still getting in the archival. And so I'd get like all these sports centers and I'd be like, okay, I'm looking for a specific thing that's going to tell a piece of this story. And then I would realize that I'd basically spent an hour just watching sports center from 1998. I was so like down my own rabbit hole and like excited about like pretending that I'm watching live sports, that it was kind of lost my mind probably, but yeah, we did it. We finished like 2 or 3 days before the movie aired. So
yeah.
Are you taking a break? Are you taking a break now? Right. You're chilling a bit. Yeah.
Today is kind of the last day when it's really hot and heavy for that. And yeah, then I'm just going to rest and try to get myself back.
Oh, nice. You're going out with a bang with us. Love it.
two quick hitters here that I think will be good perspective for anyone who doesn't know much about documentary filmmaking. When did the idea get conceived? Like, give me the timeline, just how long you've been working on this project in total.
Well, I didn't even know how long ago it was that the ESPN folks asked me to pitch them on something. But I pitched them in spring 2017 on an idea that I had. We talked about it for a little while and then just kind of, I think we just figured out it would be so expensive to do it in terms of the rights involved that we just were kind of like, that won't work. But they're like, well, what, anything else? Do you have any other ideas? And that's why I just sort of mentioned the home run race and just said, like, I'm assuming there's a reason why you haven't done it. So yeah, that was in, I remember that was called, was probably exactly 3 years ago when we had the call and I first brought it up. So yeah, it was a 3-year process, which I feel like is about average. I've made films that took 5 years kind of from the beginning to when it actually gets out into the world. I think the fastest ever was like 2. So 3's not too bad, but in the middle of it, it can certainly feel like it's just glacial. Yeah. So,
well, I think I can speak for both of us in saying that you did a phenomenal job. So
thank you.
Yeah. If you had a dating profile, patience should be the first thing listed for you, man. that's crazy. 3 years. And like, did you just roll up to ESPN or you had some dialogue? Cause obviously the Cobain and the caucus film, that had some success. So did they know who you are? They kind of had an idea of who you were, or did you kind of just like, hey, this is an idea I got.
Yeah, no, we knew each other. I got to know them a little bit more kind of when they were out and about on with the OJ film. And then I had a short at Sundance in a short doc in 2016. And in my program, there was also an ESPN 30 for 30 short, an animated short, a really good one. All the ESPN folks were at that premiere where I was also premiering mine in the same program. So I think that was probably the moment when they were first like, oh, we loved it. You know, you should come and like pitch us something when you're ready, when you have an idea. So it was a full year. It was a full year before I actually did it, but it was definitely, they were nice enough to encourage me to come by. And they're a great team. Yeah. I should say like that's, they're like the way they work, having not worked with them before, they really give you like so much support, but then really let you make the movie that you've all agreed you want to make.
Trust you. I think they trust you.
They trust you. And you know, I think if I had diverged wildly, they probably would have pulled me back, but it was great to work with a team that was as supportive and they gave notes, they gave great notes, but it wasn't, I've heard some real horror stories with other networks and platforms and they were just great.
Yeah, and there's a reason that, you know, they're the biggest sports network in the world. And, you know, I mean, the most important thing for arts and crafts is trust, man. You gotta trust the person growing the baby. You just have to.
Yeah.
You can't be too hands-on because there's too many people talking. But that's sick that they saw your other film at a festival and kind of like, you basically hit a backflip on the dance floor in front of the cool kids. That's awesome. That's great, man. Were you nervous? Were you nervous about making, cause like, it's just so different. I mean, I don't know. Cause you know the topic. Was there like a level of nervousness because maybe the guests are really high profile or it's different, you know, and it's going to be on ESPN, or you kind of trusted yourself?
I mean, we did some interviews. I mean, we didn't interview Mark and Sammy first. We did other interviews first. So I think that there was, I wouldn't say nervousness, but there were definitely some interviews where I knew that how that interview went would get back to them. So, you know, you went into some interviews where you're just like, you know, don't screw this one up because this is, they're going to hear if they think that your intentions are not what you said they were, or, you know, that you're just, you don't know what you're talking about. So,
yeah.
Speaking of interviews, you open the first interview you open with is Todd McFarlane, and I'm that was just so wild. I'm like, Spawn, what's going on here? That's I think part of that, and you touched on it a little bit, but something that I didn't necessarily know that much about, and part of this is because there's so much history in baseball, is that baseball paraphernalia goes for so much in these auctions. It's crazy. It's ridiculous. I mean, are you growing up as a baseball fan, were you seeking out, you know, just baseball paraphernalia or anything like that? Was that something you did?
No, I just thought that Todd, it was a great way to show how big the year got, you know, because it's like, as soon as you say that he paid $3 million for a baseball, which looks like every other baseball in the world that's been hit. You know, I mean, there's nothing special about that ball except that it, you know, left McGuire's bat and some fan got it in a box. You know, the fact that it went for $3 million to me was just such a great way to telegraph to the audience up front, like, this was bigger than you remember, or it was so huge that was a reasonable thing that someone thought they were doing, was to spend $3 million for that ball. But I just, you know, it was funny. I loved how he talked about the home run and how, you know,
it's serious about it. He really,
yeah. And how it's different than anything in any other sport. And it just felt like a great, great way to start the whole movie.
You sent me down.
As soon as we left him, I was like, we're starting with that.
Yeah. You sent me down a rabbit hole of like, I was like, dang, what's this guy's net worth? I went on Google right after that. That was like one of the first things I Googled after the show. I'm like, what's this guy's net worth? What's he said? Oh man, I should have paid more attention in art. And I was on the phone with Tony Dauk. If you remember him, played Kentucky basketball. Great in the 90s for them. I was on the phone. I didn't even tell him we had this afternoon. And he was like, can you believe that guy paid $3 million? And everyone else on the phone was like, dude, what are you talking? Oh, yeah, that was wild. I can't believe he did that. He was shocked that someone did that. He's like, and man, I looked at his net worth, and that was nothing. I'm like, dude, I did the same thing. It was crazy. That was a really good
answer. Yeah, I mean, he was trying to get into sports action figures at the time, and nobody was really taking him seriously because he's the Spawn guy. And, you know, when he bought the balls, he was able to get the meetings he wanted at the leagues, and he ended up getting those contracts. So I think probably he was, he was repaid more than one time for what he invested in the balls with what he was able to make creating sports action figures.
Yeah. I think you bring up the, like, people forget when pitchers are pitching, every 10 pitches, a lot of times that ball's gone. Right. And it's never seen ever again.
Changed.
I mean, it's not like
stands, yeah.
It's not like the little leagues where you're playing with that same ball the entire time, or you're playing with three or four balls. Right. Like, that ball could have been, who knows? What if that the groundskeeper guy had just swapped it, put it in his pocket, and he still has it today?
Like Anthony Rizzo, yeah, exactly. That thing. Like,
no, that was amazing. Him giving it back to McGuire. That was really, that's
good
touching.
Angle, man. Yeah. Good angle.
You did a good job.
Yeah, did a good job.
I know we said that already.
Yeah,
but you did
told
a good job.
You, but we appreciated it. Two more, and then we'll let you rock and roll, brother.
Cool.
We always ask people that. Well, first, before we get to the last question, we always ask people. You're a documentarian, and outside of your films, we have our five, and we'll tell you then. We won't go into great detail, but we want to hear your five favorite documentaries of all time. Doesn't have to be sports. Could be one of mine, not sports. Just so everyone knows, doesn't have to be sports.
I mean, it's hard because I
do you watch a lot?
Like, I do, yeah. But cool. One of the great things about the documentary world is, although we've lost some in the last few years, I made my first doc in 2002, premiered at South By, and the first day I went to a breakfast and I was sitting next to Albert Maysles, one of the great Verite filmmakers of all time. He and his brother David, the Maysles brothers, made Grey Gardens and Salesman. So Salesman is one of my five. Got to know D.A. Pennybaker pretty well. Penny made some of the most incredible music documentaries, like Bob Dylan's Don't Look Back, and that's one of my five. Steve James, who made Hoop Dreams, an incredible film. That would be
one of my list too.
Yeah, one of my five. Godfrey Reggio made this incredible, for his debut, he made this kind of experimental masterpiece, Crayonascazzi. That's been really influential to me.
What did that cover?
That is just, it's Crayonascazzi, you got to watch it, man. It's a Philip Glass score, and it is just like an hour and a half of visuals. And it's all just about how everything is on Earth is out of balance. Mm-hmm. And it was made in sometime in the 80s. I saw it in my friend's basement, and people might have been smoking some weed. But I was about to say,
I'm gonna have to go back to Los Angeles to watch that one.
It's that kind of
kill the blinds everywhere.
Yeah, it's that kind of a film. And then Barbara Kopple's Harlan County, USA. I just think that's a great example of someone tackling an issue, but doing so by being not just having, a kind of a didactic point of view, but actually being amongst people and seeing what's really happening as she's covering a coal miner strike in West Virginia. So there's five. I could name 20, but there's five.
No, it's great, man. We're going to watch. I haven't seen a few of those, so now I'm going to watch them. If I'm taking documentary advice from the mailman, I'm going to have to listen to the pro and go delve into it. Toss, you want to give your five so AJ's not alone? I'll give mine after that.
Sure. I'm a basketball fan first and foremost. Hoop Dreams is on there for me. I realized in like reflection on thinking on this question that a lot of the documentaries that I've seen have to do with either climbing or extreme sports. I don't know why, but they just do. Meru is one that is phenomenal. I also had Free Solo on there, but I'm gonna cancel. I think I like Meru better than I like Free Solo, but I think Free Solo is just gives incredible insight into, again, like mental health and just like. His amygdala is completely shot, and
almost threw up during that. We watched that together. You almost threw up. He almost yacked. So did I. I was like, Jesus.
That's a tough film to watch.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I empathize completely with his girlfriend in those scenes where he's like, I'll see you tomorrow, whatever, and she's like, you might not come back. That stuff it's crazy. McConkey, which is about Shane McConkey. I don't know if you've ever seen that one.
I haven't.
That's a good one. It's a tragic story. And then
spoiler alert,
a documentary that's tragic. You're going to know it's tragic at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
The best that never was the Marcus Dupree doc is one of Josh and our favorite. And then I recently watched Going Clear, which is the Scientology documentary.
Yeah.
I part of that is it was so informative on a subject I knew nothing about. And just what went on in that organization, I'm not even going to call it a religion, was absolutely ridiculous.
Damn, getting political on TCS. Nice.
No, I mean that's the angle of the documentary, but just kind of it's pretty crazy. It's eye-opening. So yeah. that's the cool thing about documentaries, right? You get to learn about things that you might not know that much about.
Putting the shoes,
yeah,
kind of.
Exactly.
Free Solo, Super Size Me. Used to be a fat kid. I was just hungry after that movie, but it was still really cool. Doc and Daryl, because that was wild to me. I was talking to somebody the other day, like, damn, I'm like, Doc and Daryl, man, that guy was smoking crack. And someone was like, I thought he was smoking meth. I'm like, once you're smoking crack, you're smoking meth, man. That's a slippery slope. That one was bonkers, more than a game. I'm a huge LeBron guy, always have been. And I'm a Celtics guy, so without bias, that was great for me too. Those are our docs. We'll throw that. Nick, our other guy, Nick, who couldn't come tonight because he had to take care of some family stuff. The four of us will throw that. We'll make a cute little graphic. It'll look nice. You don't have to put it on the mantle, but it'll be cool. And then we always ask everybody this, AJ, what's your favorite sports memory? Could be from you playing, watching, reporting, anything, man.
One of it's exactly my favorite. I'll give you two. One that is crazy is that I was at the Cardinals Dodgers game when Fernando Tatis hit two grand slams in the same inning. So that was incredible. A, because it was such an, I mean, you have to, you can imagine what an insane inning it was.
Dude, that's ridiculous.
Just to see it. But the whole aspect of, you know, when he came back up to bat, he's coming up to bat and then the bases are loaded and you're just like, you just had this feeling like he was going to do it again.
Was and that the second time in the, nuts. In the second at bat in the inning or the third?
His second at bat in the inning. Yeah. He hit the second grand slam. So that was pretty nuts. I've been at some, I'm a big Blues fan again, being from St. Louis. So I've been at some, playoff games when they've won a series and obviously with them winning the cup last year was pretty special. But the wildest sports memory I think probably that I ever had, I was in college when Mizzou was playing Colorado and Colorado got five downs. Colorado was ranked number one in the country and they were behind and the time was ticking down, the clock was running out. And the refs gave them a fifth down when they should have had to turn the ball over, which would have allowed Mizzou to dethrone. Mizzou had always been terrible. Would have allowed Mizzou to dethrone the number one team in the ranked team in the country. But the refs gave Colorado another down. They were able to get a first down and score and won that game. But in the stadium, everyone is screaming at the refs, you know, that it's fifth down. And it somehow, like, it just, the game kept playing. And I thought there was going to be a riot when Colorado won that game. It had national title implications in the end, too. It was in 1990.
You found your next documentary.
I was about to say, Taz, I don't want a percent. You got it, but where the idea's planted right then and there. You heard it here first. But yeah, man, two quick things on that, actually. First of all, if that happened in Texas, riots. Like, full on. I want you to know that. In Texas football, if you've never been to a game, people will be – I would have rioted in the streets. I would have burned something. Back in college, that's just who I was. I'll admit it. I'm mad enough. Two, the Fernando Tatis. It's like everyone's favorite trivia, like who hit two grand slams in the inning. And if you know baseball, you know that. I was at a restaurant one time. I was getting quick food, and I was re-listening to one of our shows just to like get, you know, just to learn, right? And he goes, "Oh, what do you listen to?" I'm like, "Oh, I run a sports podcast," and you know, I'm listening to it, and he's like, "Oh, cool. Do you know, you like baseball?" I'm like, "Yeah, I love baseball." He goes, "All right, I have a trivia question." Like trivia? I'm like, "Yeah, I love trivia." He goes, "All right, cool. If you get this right, I'll give you lunch on the house." He goes, "Who hit two grand slams in the same inning?" I'm like, "Dude, just give me the sandwich." It's like, come on, I'm not doing it. Come on, man. You can't come out. AJ, thank you, man. Thank you. We had a great time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Congratulations on an amazing doc. Go get some rest, man. Seriously, all right? Relax.
Oh, well,
Have a pina colada, throw some sand on the ground, pretend you're at the beach, or you're in Los Angeles, so just go, honestly. Yeah. It's not that crowded, we've been. But thank you, man. We appreciate you.
Of course. My pleasure.
All right, man. Take care, brother.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Told you. Great one. Really cool. Love documentaries. Been on a documentary spree lately, and this was an awesome one to be a part of, and great to hear his insight on making the documentary. And how he felt on all things steroids, all things involving Maguire and Sosa, and just about the era in general. Really, really cool to hear the documentarian talk about it after just watching it on Sunday. And as always, we're brought to you by betonline.ag. Go to betonline.ag, use the promo code MYPOD100, the match your deposit up to $1,000. It's a no-brainer. Go make some money. We're not going to beg you. It's just friendly advice. Some also friendly advice to you guys. Drag both feet in bounds. Swing on a full count. Rip that puck. Hit that putt. Hit your PKs because they're free and hit your free throws. Why? Because they are free. We out you. We love you.
Derek Jeter with fantasy.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.